Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Today we take a look at one of the fastest growing elements in today's business world. It's called the gig economy. Just like musicians or actors who get gigs from time to time, the gigs we're talking about are temporary jobs tied to specific projects. It takes a page from the freelance world and is assisted by today's technology. Joining me to talk about it are Miriam Cherry, professor at the St. Louis University School of Law and director of the Weffel Center for Employment Law. Stephanie Leffler is CEO and co-founder of OneSpace. It connects the dots between freelancers and the companies who need their skills. It has done so tens of thousands of times. Thank you, ladies, so much for being with us. Great to have you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Stephanie, let me begin with you. Tens of thousands of times makes me think this is something that has really caught on.
You know, it has. Just last year, we saw more than a million people try independent work for the first time. And so it's something that technology originally enabled and allowed to grow more quickly than it might have otherwise. And so we see people learning about all different ways to supplement their income or even in some cases turn to the gig economy full time.
Who are these people?
So it's a big range. You know, there are lots of studies out there. One of the more popular was done by the McKinsey Institute in October. And when you look at it, it's people who have everywhere from a high school education all the way through postgraduate work. It spans the gamut in terms of male, female, and really what their skills are. So I would say just about anyone can find work in the gig economy if they so choose.
What kinds of jobs are we talking about? Does it run the full gamut?
It really does. I mean, a really popular example is Uber. So, you know, if you have the skills to drive a car, you can be part of the gig economy. People sell things on eBay or Etsy. And then where we step in is when it comes to digital work. So anything from, being a writer to being able to shoot and edit photos, take videos, reconcile accounts if you have a finance background. So I would say it really does run the gamut.
Miriam Cherry, Stephanie has just mentioned Uber, and of course we've all been reading lately about the legal problems that have ensued as a result of that. It would seem to me that maybe this is representative of other businesses that might have legal issues.
Well, yes. So one of the issues, I think, is the classification of workers, and this has become a concern for many in the gig economy. I've been tracking over the last probably 5 to 6 years about 20 different litigations that are actually going on about this status, because many companies will say, we only have independent contractors here. But in fact, when you look at the substance of the relationship and you see how much control is being exercised over the people who are doing the work, they look more like employees. Hmm. And so there's been a number of cases that have been winding their way through the courts. But so far, many of these cases have settled. And companies have paid settlements to workers. They've instituted arbitration or other provisions. But there really hasn't been an answer so far, at least in the United States. There's been some litigation in other countries that have established that Uber drivers are employees. But we haven't figured that out yet. And we haven't figured out really the optimal way to regulate some of these business relationships.
What are the kinds of complaints that are filed?
So there are complaints for a number of different things. Many of them are about the Fair Labor Standards Act or the analog under state law, which are questions about minimum wage. So how much, what are fair wages for the work that people are doing? And are they making enough money to reach the minimum wage? But others of these are things for workers' compensation. You know, someone's injured on the job and they file for something based on an injury. And if they were an employee, it would be clear that they were covered for this workplace injury. But then because we have this new area of the gig economy, there are some questions about whether they should be covered.
Are employers obligated to pay minimum wage, at least minimum wage?
Oh, employers most definitely are, yes.
Well, they're employers we're talking about, aren't they?
Well, I think that's the question and the crux of many of these litigations is if you have someone who's just working on a one-off basis for Uber, they're giving someone a ride on the way to the office, working on a very casual basis, you probably wouldn't call that person an employee. But on the other hand, if you have someone who's treating this as a professional job and working at it 40 hours a week, and they're being controlled by an algorithm that tells them exactly where to go, that's when I think the question becomes really interesting and they do tend to look more like an employer.
We'll get back to a specific Uber situation in a moment or two. But Stephanie, let me turn to you. These are all things, I'm sure, with which you're familiar and have to contend with.
They are. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting is that one of the great parts about the gig economy is the flexibility that it affords to the average person who engages. So, you know, if you have a full-time job, but you happen to have one spare hour per week, the gig economy does have an opportunity where you can actually fill that hour in a meaningful way. But the question of control and what is control is one of these key legal themes in this issue. And there are really a number of directions where you could take this conversation. What does it mean to the individual? What does it mean to the company? But at the end of the day, where we sit is in a place where companies that I've seen are being forced to either, you know, become more casual in their control of these people, which really does minimize the overall opportunity. So if I tell you less, that means you can do something less valuable for me, which means I pay you less. Or they're turning people into full-time employees, which is interesting because a lot of the people who are doing work in the gig economy prefer not to be full-time employees, which is why they're engaging in the gig economy in the first place. So, you know, after taking all of this in, I feel like there's a missing classification in our system for this new type of work. It's something new where old laws are being applied. And I think everyone on all ends of the spectrum are trying to figure out what that right answer is. But, you know, we have not reached that as of yet.
I want to turn that back to Miriam in a moment. But very, very quickly, who hires you at OneSpace? Is it the employer or is it the freelancer?
So freelancers sign up at our website on OneSpace to become somebody who's qualified to look through our catalog of jobs, if you think it that way, and choose what they want to work on. Big companies hire us to use our software in order to be able to find and coordinate the efforts of a large freelance workforce. So generally, our customers are companies who are trying to get something that needs to be done at a reasonably large scale accomplished with freelancers.
So simply, you just put the names out there, and either side can go from that point.
Exactly. It's a little more complicated than that. I'd say we're more highly curated. So we would, you know, give people tests when they first join to figure out what they're good at, what they're not good at. We'd put them through the paces a little bit so that when a company does engage with them, they know that their skills are appropriately represented.
Miriam, back to the issue of the legal side of this, as Stephanie has just indicated, law has to change. I assume you agree with that. And if so, is it changing? Is there evidence that that's happening?
So I mentioned that other nations are taking a different perspective on this. And the UK actually had a decision that came out earlier in the year that was about Uber drivers and how there does seem to be a lot of control that's being exerted, and those look more like employees. And I'm intrigued by this concept or notion that Stephanie mentioned of a separate category that would work for gig work. But other countries have actually tried that before, not in relation to gig work, but in relation to other kinds of independent work, independent businesses, but people who have been outsourced from other jobs. So say, for example, someone who used to work in-house as, let's say, a plumber or on some kind of construction job. But now the work is being contracted out to them as if they were a completely independent business, but they're still doing all their work for that one large company. And this is actually part of a larger trend of outsourcing, fissuring the workplace, and taking tasks that used to be done in-house and outsourcing them elsewhere. And so I think that really there's a bigger issue that's happening there, and that's one of the concerns. So other countries have looked at that and said, we need some kind of regulation here for potential third way or third category. Canada, for example, brings in those kinds of relationships as a dependent contractor is what it's called. Other countries have also tried this too and didn't have a lot of success with it, because what it ended up doing was that many places took what were employees and downgraded them into this dependent contractor status instead of raising people up, which I think would be a goal of getting more benefits and getting protections, things like workers' comp, to people who need it, who are using this as their full-time job.
I want to offer the opportunity for our listening audience to get into this conversation. If you've been involved on either side of this gig economy, we'd love to hear from you as employer or potential freelance employee. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stopublicradio.org. Send us an email at talk@stopublicradio.org, that is, or send us a tweet at STL on air. Now, back to Stephanie Leffler. Are you dealing with foreign companies as well?
We do a little bit, but most of our clients are based here in the U.S. Part of the reason for that is the laws and regulations become a lot more complex when we are the, you know, call it the broker of these relationships, and we sit here in the U.S. If we have both companies and potential freelancers in other countries, it gets pretty complicated. We've done it in a few cases, but as of now, we're primarily U.S.
Can a case be made, Stephanie, that this, in a sense, is undermining the economy in terms of the traditional economy, I should say? It would seem to me that traditional workers might be fired because these freelancers are out there. We're talking about overtime. We're talking about minimum wage and all the rest of it.
Well, I think, sure, you could make that argument. I think a really healthy parallel is when you think about work that looks like this, it kind of is a parallel to what we saw in the Industrial Revolution, where, you know, when the Industrial Revolution first began, I think artisans who were used to making their craft from start to finish were concerned that the average person wouldn't be able to exist in this new world. And what we see today is work being broken apart in much the same way as it was. So I think there's an argument to be made that said people may be fired, this work might be outsourced. But there's another argument that says as companies become more efficient and can produce their service or their goods at a lower cost, that they will be able to scale more rapidly and therefore provide their, you know, grow their internal workforce while they're also growing their external workforce.
Miriam, it would seem to me that this is a greater benefit to the employer than it would be to the employee. But they don't have to pay benefits. There are just so many different things you can look at. You don't have to have equipment in-house for these folks.
Well, I think there are some very innovative pieces of the gig economy and some neat ways that this can be employed. But if the main essence of what is being sold is just the we're going to cut out the benefits piece and we're going to de-skill work, then that's not really an innovation. That's just undercutting different standards. So, you know, my general thought is try to focus on the piece that matches people up, that makes things more efficient. But at the same time, I wrote an article about corporate social responsibility and crowd work. And I think it makes sense to figure out what good work looks like and what compliance with the rules look like. Again, right now, we're not sure exactly what those rules might be. But I think those are important things to take into account and to think about moving forward.
We are very early in this whole process, needless to say. A lot of things still being worked out. I have to take a break. Let's do that now. We'll come back and talk about more about the gig economy. Again, we'd love to hear from you. If you're involved in this one way or another, we'd love to hear from you at 382-8255. My guests in studio are Miriam Cherry. She is with St. Louis University School of Law. And Stephanie Leffler is the CEO and co-founder of OneSpace, which, as I put it earlier, connect the dots between employers and freelancers who are looking for work. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Stephanie Leffler and Miriam Cherry. Let me, Stephanie, take this going back to Uber for just a moment. We have a new Uber driver's email saying, it's not an industry from which any sort of professional advancement could be expected. Once you're an Uber or Lyft driver, that's it. There's no extra incentive for doing a good job. You get paid the same as drivers who are mediocre or outright bad. What about it?
Well, so I can't necessarily speak to how Uber's system works. I know that they do have a rating system, and drivers certainly strive to maintain a high rating with their passengers. But I think it's the nature of the work in general. You know, if I'm an entrepreneurial-minded person and I start driving for Uber, I think there are, there's certainly not within the Uber organization a place for me to advance, but I certainly can learn the craft well and potentially parlay that into an entrepreneurial career of my own, thinking about, you know, maybe I want to start a shipping company or a trucking company. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the nature of the work in general and isn't necessarily reflective of the gig economy in that particular instance.
Any thoughts about that, Miriam?
Well, I do think that ratings and there have been several issues about the ratings. The ratings for driving for Uber are very high. People mm-hmm. don't realize that if you mm-hmm. give someone less than 5 stars, it's actually really bad for them. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's one of the things that I think the drivers have a lot of complaints about is that they're being rated sometimes arbitrarily by customers and there's not a lot of recourse. And that's one of the things that they actually were suing about, in the latest mm-hmm. litigations. And one of the points of the settlement is that they are required now to go to an arbitration, not just disconnecting people from the app if their ratings fall below a certain number. That was causing a lot of tension, and I think the drivers were quite upset about that. I think rightfully so. People want a method for improving what they're doing, not just sort of an arbitrary number.
Yeah. I have an email here from Tom who writes, when the gig economy is discussed, sometimes the commentators speak as if the gig economy results in an average standard of living that is at least equal to the old permanent employment-based economy. Is this really true? Any thoughts?
So I can attest that there are absolutely enough opportunities in the gig economy today for somebody with a modest set of skills to be able to make the same amount that they would on an annual basis if they were earning in minimum wage, working in a shop or something like that. So I do think that that's possible. On our platform, because of the flexibility, you see people who make as little as a few dollars a month because they might do one task that takes them 3 or 4 minutes. And then you see other people who are pulling together what I'd classify as a highly respectable income if you annualized what they're making. So there is a range.
I guess it depends a lot on how much of a self-starter you are.
It does. Yeah. That's a really important aspect. Just like, being an entrepreneur in any other sense of the word, it's all about the effort that you put in and what you do to market your skills in the gig economy.
Go ahead, Miriam.
I think one difference might be that there is a certain search cost to things. If you're, looking for the next piece of work that's coming in, there's a certain period of time, mm-hmm. if you are trying to do this as full-time work or equivalent to it, that you miss out on the income during that period of time. And that's something that if you can't count on a steady stream of work, then even if you're being paid potentially a respectable wage by the hour, you have to factor in those search costs, search time as well.
It seems to me, though, this is where Stephanie comes in, because you have the information on your site. People looking for work, if it's out there, they can go after it.
Absolutely. The way our site works is it's a pretty interesting process and really was designed originally to be friendly to the freelancer in that once they have a certain skill on the platform, when companies post work, really all they have to do is think of it as a queue where they can grab as many of those jobs as they want or can complete. And the whole idea was to eliminate some of that search cost and make it easier for the person to be able to do one or do 20 jobs today if that's the time that they have available.
And to a certain degree, the potential employee, the freelancer, has already been vetted.
That's right. Right. That's right.
Right. Let's take a call. Sarah's joining us from St. Louis. Sarah, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to join the conversation. I've been a part of the gig economy for about 5 years now in St. Louis. It's been quite unexpected, and I wouldn't do it any other way. I'm actually the founder of my own company now, Engage Taste, and I also have about 6 other jobs that I do. I write for several local publications. I work for a real estate developer and constantly meeting new people and starting new projects every week, and I find it something that I didn't even know I wanted until I was in the middle of it.
Sarah, thank you so much for the call. Well, there's certainly a very positive reaction to what's going on. But she also points out, as we've indicated here, you've got to be a self-starter. I mean, she's not only done the intermittent jobs, she's become an entrepreneur in the process. Yeah.
You know, when we talk about the gig economy at OneSpace, one of the things that we're constantly promoting to freelancers is that this really is their brand, their personal brand is their business. And whether they're doing small jobs or they're taking on bigger projects, I think that's the healthiest and best way to think about it, because you do have to, you know, to be successful, you have to think about networking and pulling together the smartest and best jobs that are going to make the most money for you or make the most sense, help you learn something new. And so I think it is very much an entrepreneurial pursuit. I would not advise somebody who didn't have that makeup to consider the gig economy something that could really help them live, maybe as a supplement, but more of a hobby.
Sure. We have an email here. Susan writes, and maybe Miriam, this is for you. Please address the need for affordable health insurance for gig economy workers. This is another part of what we were talking about earlier. And of course, you have the Obamacare thing in the middle of all of this now and the attempts to change that.
Yeah. So I think one of the other big issues is whether we want to think about, given the increase in, I was talking about workplace fisherization before and outsourcing, whether we want to think about some type of portable benefits that would follow someone from job to job, or ratings even that transcend one particular platform, a way of knowing that people have certain skills. But coming back to benefits, I think it's a really interesting point to think that we've always sort of looked at benefits as going along with full-time employment. And if that relationship is breaking down, or we're seeing people with six different jobs, as the caller had, how do we make sure that people have adequate benefits? And I think those are one of the major challenges that we face with looking at the type of work that we see in the gig economy. Mm. And it's important to think about those social aspects as well.
Of course. Very quickly, Stephanie, are these workers graded in any way by employers through OneSpace? In other words, if I do a job for firm X, do they have an opportunity to say, this guy's great, I wouldn't hesitate to hire him again?
They do. There are really two opportunities on the OneSpace platform. The first is we maintain an overall, very simple rating that just represents how much of your work has been accepted with, call it good standing, and how much has been flagged as problematic. And that's kind of pretty big across everybody. But each individual user or employer on the OneSpace platform will be able to rate the people who are doing the work for them and maintain that rating, which is only visible to that particular company.
Right. Is that a good thing, Miriam?
Well, I mean, that's interesting. And it depends on who's doing the rating, how they're being evaluated. Does the worker have an opportunity procedurally to say, you know, actually that rating wasn't fair?
Right.
And this is one of the critiques, I think, of Crowdwork and, you know, Amazon Mechanical Turk and some of the other platforms, that workers have complained, hey, my work is getting rejected and I don't know why it is, or I'm not getting paid for the time I put in. And that's really problematic from a standpoint of people doing work and, again, wanting the basics just to know what they're doing right or what they're doing wrong.
Time is winding down. I want to get some more calls in. Thomas in Florissant, you're up next. Go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Hi. So I've been a musician. I've been part of the gigging economy for pretty much my entire life. I was really kind of wondering, and I'm glad that the previous email kind of started this question, but I was really wondering, what with the trend moving towards a more gigging economy, what is there to incentivize large companies to, you know, take care of the people that work for them?
All right. Thanks for the call. Thoughts, Stephanie?
Well, I think there's a major incentive for big companies to support the gig economy. And to me, supporting the gig economy means to make sure that it makes sense for the people who are providing the labor as well as the companies who are consuming the labor. So for big companies, what we see when they use the gig economy is the ability to move faster, to do it generally with a higher degree of quality than they can do it with full-time employees because of the specialization that's possible, and also to save money because of some of the areas of overhead where they don't have to spend. If you don't have to have a parking space and a desk for somebody, you can do it more effectively. That means that there should be more money to invest in things like providing portable health benefits. Now, the law makes this a little bit difficult because companies like OneSpace, who might be a perfect place for somebody to get portable health care, for example, we don't do those things yet because there's so much gray area. We worry that that might push us closer towards appearing to have more control or, you know, being kind of tied more deeply with these workers than we can be right now. So once again, I think more conversation is what's going to get us there.
Miriam, what is the incentive for any employer to hire a full-time worker anymore?
Well, that's a great question. You do know what you're getting, and you can invest, the worker can invest their time, their knowledge, specific capital to the employer's business. And, you know, there's certain things that you wouldn't want to just send out on an open call. That wouldn't make any sense to do that way. You've got to develop a relationship of trust with your workers and expect them to invest back in your business. But, you know, I want to come back to, I think, some of the points we've been talking about you know, taking care of the workers, which I think is what the caller was raising, because labor is not disconnected from people. And labor really is not just a human labor is not a technology. And it's something that we've got to think about how we make sure that the people behind the app or behind the platform are actually being looked out for as well.
I didn't think the next thing that the that these freelancers have to worry about are robots because they're out there as well. We have about a minute left. Let's put a bottom line on this. Miriam, let me ask you, what's the word of caution? Is there a cautionary flag you want to raise with all of this or something point you'd like to make?
Sure. Well, as I said, I think labor is not a technology. We have to think about all the sides of this, where we're coming from with the platform, but also the people who are performing the work. And think about what the standards are and why those standards are there. They make sense. They make sense to think about things like minimum wage, workers' compensation. They're there for a reason, and they're there because we know that workers need some protection.
15 seconds for Stephanie.
I think to come at this from the other side, companies can get a huge benefit. And I think it's important to understand that companies also see that side of it as well. And coming up with a way that we can put both groups together with maximum benefit is ultimately what we're looking for.
I want to thank you so much, Stephanie Leffler and Miriam Cherry, for being with us. Fascinating conversation. Great talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, Steve Potter tells us about the Missouri Chamber Music Festival. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.